Chapter 16. Cop Killers. The London Metropolitan Police Force came into being in the year 1829. It was the brainchild of the Home Secretary, Sir Robert Peel. Consequently, the new policemen became known as Bobbies. The nickname was not totally affectionate, however, for the people of London hated them. The old watchmen and parish constables who had kept order were just public employees, like rat catchers and street sweepers. These uniformed men were officials, whose business was to smell out offences against the law and to put the offenders in jail. As a consequence, it was a risky job to be a policeman in the 1830s. On June the 29th, 1830, Police Constable Grantham saw two drunken Irishmen quarrelling over a woman in Somers Town in North London. He tried to separate them, and the men and the woman turned on him and knocked him down. The men put in the boot, kicking him brutally on the temple. He died shortly afterwards, thus becoming the first English policeman to die in the course of execution of his duty. The murderers walked off and were never brought to justice. 6 weeks later, there was an incident that must have confirmed the London poor in their view that they were better off without the police. On August the 16th, Police Constable John Long accosted three suspicious-looking characters in Mecklenburgh Square, Gray's Inn Road. One of them pulled a knife and stabbed Long to death. There was a hue and cry. A police constable who came on the scene saw a man running and grabbed him. The man protested that he was chasing one of the murderers. A youth who was sitting on a doorstep was arrested by a police inspector. The youth protested that he was waiting for a friend, whereupon the police arrested the friend too. All three were taken into court, but the magistrate, reasoning that it was unlikely that a murderer would be sitting on a doorstep, discharged two of the defendants. However, a tradesman's boy and a prostitute identified the remaining man as one of the policeman's assailants. No one asked the boy why at an earlier stage he had admitted that he had not even seen the murder. The accused man, almost certainly innocent, was hanged. One has a feeling that the early police force felt it was better to hang the wrong man than nobody at all. In May 1833, a rather mild revolutionary group called the National Political Union called for a public meeting of anarchists and revolutionists in Coldbath Fields, not far from the site of Constable Long's murder. Their revolutionary programme was hardly extreme. They simply wanted votes for working men. The Home Secretary didn't like the idea. He told the Commissioner of Police to ban the meeting. The ban was ignored. A crowd gathered, and a speaker on a soapbox asked the crowd to be orderly and peaceable. They had little alternative, being surrounded by about 800 policemen and troops. Other speeches were made, and a police spy slipped away to report that revolution and sedition was being preached. The man in charge of the police, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Rowan, who had fought at Waterloo, ordered his men to advance slowly, holding their truncheons, and to halt frequently to allow innocent bystanders to get out of the way. The police advanced, and were booed and pelted with stones. This angered the force, and they began hitting out wildly, knocking down women and children as well as men. Police Constable Robert Cully tried to capture one of the anarchists' banners and hit the man with a truncheon. The man drew a knife and stabbed Cully in the chest. He staggered a few yards and fell dead. Cully was a married man of 27 whose wife was about to have a baby. The coroner's jury that met to consider how Cully met his death were not disposed to sympathise with the police. They were mostly respectable tradesmen, and they felt that the police should have minded their own business and permitted the traditional British right of free speech. They asked the police witnesses impertinent questions, and then, when they were sent out to reach a verdict, they told the coroner they were unable to agree. The coroner did what was quite common in those days. He told them that they would stay in the room, without food or drink, until they did agree. The result was that the angry jury produced a verdict that enraged the police and delighted the British public, that the man who killed Constable Cully, and who had never been caught, was only guilty of justifiable homicide. The spectators in the court cheered. The jury were treated as heroes and found themselves wined and dined for their defiance of the Bobbies. This raises again the fundamental question. Were the public simply protesting against this frightening new innovation, a police force, or was it rather the expression of something deeper, that idealistic anarchism which is perhaps a profound and permanent part of human nature? For it's not only, for instance, primitive and peaceable societies, such as the South Sea Islanders, who feel they have no need for civil authority. Slum dwellers in London's East End and country dwellers in tiny rural villages feel the same. The poor may fight among themselves, but they also help one another. In the poverty of Whitechapel and the Ratcliffe Highway, there was a strong community spirit, which could be seen occasionally when a whole street hired a horse bus for an expedition to the country, or families went hop-picking to the fields of Kent, sleeping rough under the hedges. As to country people, anyone who's ever moved from a city into a quiet country district has noticed the friendliness and warmth, and how a total stranger may go out of his way to offer help. This is what had convinced 19th-century peaceful anarchists, such as the Russians Kropotkin and Malatesta, that men are good at heart, and that to subject them to harsh processes of the law is an indignity to human nature. To some extent, it is undoubtedly the modern commercial metropolis, with its fairly well-to-do inhabitants living in flats, that has eroded this spirit of cooperation among ordinary people. No doubt Kropotkin, Bakunin and Proudhon and the rest were being absurdly idealistic when they imagined that a whole modern state could be run without the police, army or government. Yet they had grasped something about human nature that many people have lost sight of. That man is basically gregarious and prepared to help his fellow creatures, because he needs help from them. This explains some of the deep and widespread hostility to the police that persists even in our crime-ridden society. It is, of course, due partly to a kind of stupidity, to the confused reasoning of socially immature individuals, but it is more than that. There is also the obscure longing for a more innocent form of society, where the brotherhood of man is a reality. Many anarchists would agree that society needs law and order, because there are always people who may commit violent crimes. But the answer, according to them, is to have the police purely as guardians of the peace, like the sheriff of an old wild western town, whose business was to chase rustlers and stop visiting cowboys from shooting up the local saloon, not to go around looking for people who've parked their horses on double yellow lines. This view actually offers a ray of hope in a society where the killing of policemen has become an increasing problem. In America, more police are killed every year than have been killed in England since the beginning of the century. If the police killing is pure antisocial viciousness, then this is a reason for gloom. But if it also springs from some distorted impulse of defiance and human dignity, then a little intelligent thinking may provide some of the answers. The outline of some of these answers can be seen in the subsequent history of the police force. In America, on the continent of Europe, and especially in Russia, the police continued to be regarded by most ordinary people as an instrument of oppression. "Police and militia, the bloodhounds of capitalism, are willing to murder," declared a headline in the Arbeiter Zeitung, the Chicago German-language anarchist daily. On May 4, 1885, police moved in to break up a strikers' meeting in the Haymarket Square when someone threw a bomb into the police ranks. The explosion was terrific, and when the bleeding and screaming confusion died down, 7 policemen were lying dead. In the following year, 8 anarchists arrested at random from the crowd were sentenced to death for the killings. It started a chain reaction of shootings, explosions, strike-breaking, and the deliberate starvation of workers and their families, and violence continued intermittently for the next half a century. The execution of Sacco and Vanzetti in 1927 marked the end of this phase of militant anarchism in America. On May Day 1891, French anarchists were dragged into the police station at Clichy and beaten viciously. At their trial, one of them shouted, "If the police come, do not hesitate to kill them like the dogs they are." On November the 8th, 1892, a bomb exploded in a police station in the Avenue de l'Opéra in Paris, blowing 6 policemen to fragments, including the one who had been rash enough to carry it. And once again, there were explosions, assassinations and executions that continued for decades. In 1892, anarchists robbed a train travelling from Paris to Lyon, and one of them murdered an army officer who resisted. A few days later, police arrested an anarchist called Jacques Mestislav Charrier, who had been overheard boasting of the robbery in a bar. 7 days after the robbery, acting on information forced from Charrier, police ambushed 2 men in the Rue des Ternes in Paris. Both men were killed, and so was a police inspector. Charrier declared in court, "I am a desperate enemy of society, and I defy you to take my head." And although he screamed and pleaded for mercy as he was dragged to the guillotine, other French anarchists felt that the great war against the bloodhounds of capitalism was going on. In England, however, the situation had changed in favour of the police. To begin with, the English have always been traditionally lenient towards political offenders, When Karl Marx fled to England in 1850, he was amazed that the English police were unarmed and that the authorities did not seem particularly concerned about the dangerous revolutionaries in their midst. Anarchist and socialist clubs met openly, yet no one seemed to worry. Jack the Ripper actually committed one of his murders, of Elizabeth Stride, in the backyard of one of these revolutionary clubs for foreign immigrants in 1888. Marx was also astonished to find himself in a country where people seemed quite to like their policemen. The British bobby was usually an easygoing, kindly sort of man, and although there were still plenty of streets in London's East End where a policeman would never venture alone, no one actually regarded them as capitalist bullies. Anybody who wanted to express that opinion was welcome to stand up on a soapbox in Hyde Park and say so, while several bobbies looked benevolently on in case the crowd felt like attacking the speaker. A number of violent incidents actually caused wide sympathy and support for the police. For example, there was the Tottenham outrage in 1909, when two young anarchists from the Baltic states tried to take a payroll from the men delivering it to Sherman's rubber factory. The wages clerk struggled, shots were fired, and the two men fled. Unarmed policemen chased them. The first victim of the gunman was a small boy who fell dead. Next, a policeman named Tyler was shot through the neck and killed. The chase pounded on through back gardens and across allotments, and more policemen were wounded. In the Chingford Road, the men leapt onto a passing tram and forced the conductor to drive it. An elderly passenger lost his nerve and was shot in the throat. As the gunman leapt off the tram, a milkman who ran towards them was shot in the chest. The men stopped a horse-drawn grocer's van and ordered the teenage driver to whip up the horse. Policemen on bicycles, one of them carrying a cutlass, hurtled after them. Passing a policeman, one of the men fired, hitting him in the foot. The policeman blew his whistle and, despite his wound, joined in the chase. The anarchists leapt out of the van as their pursuers gained ground and raced across fields again. At a fence, one of them fell. Before the police could reach him, he had shot himself through the brain, and he died later in hospital. Finally, the police cornered the other man in a cottage. Two policemen burst into the child's bedroom where he was hiding and shot him through the head. The chase had lasted 2 hours and covered 6 miles. A policeman and a child had been killed, 7 more policemen shot and 14 other people injured. It was the kind of incident that rallied warm support around the British police. So did the shootings in Houndsditch a year later, when 3 policemen were killed and 4 more injured by a gang of foreign burglars. And when the Houndsditch affair culminated in the famous siege of Sydney Street, everyone in England was delighted that the foreign desperados had been trapped. On the whole, the British public had decided that its police force was to be trusted. The situation in America is different. The high incidence of police murders is due less to public hostility than to the general climate of violence and the permissive American gun laws. 2 typical cases of 1971, one in England, one in America, will serve to underline the difference between the two countries. On the evening of June the 27th, 1971, Detective Constable Ian Coward, who was 29, was driving through Reading when he noticed a white Morris car that was swinging across the road in a manner that suggested the driver was drunk. When the car stopped in front of a restaurant, he got out and approached it. There were 2 men inside. He asked the driver for his identification, and the driver, a young, unshaven man, got out to look for it. Coward went back to his own car, got into the driver's seat, and told the man to get in beside him. At this moment, the other man approached the police car, pulled a gun, and fired 9 bullets into Coward. As the policeman fell across the seat and through the open passenger door, the other man kicked him. Then both ran back to their car and drove off. Incredibly, Coward was still alive. He was rushed to hospital, but on July the 23rd he died. Witnesses to the shooting were able to pick out the 2 men from the rogues' gallery of mugshots. They were identified as Arthur Skingle, who was 25, and Peter Sparrow, 28. Both had criminal records, and Skingle, the gunman, had been released from prison, where he'd served a sentence for robbery with violence only 10 days earlier. The men drove the white Morris to a spot a few miles away and set it on fire with petrol. It was a routine matter for the police to pick up the murderers, who were both sentenced to full life terms. On November the 29th, 1971, Sergeant Mike McNeil of Albany, New York, pulled in a car driver for questioning. His driver's licence didn't correspond to the car's registration number. While the driver was being interrogated at the section house, his 3 companions, who were waiting outside in the car, escaped. McNeil went after them, caught them up a block away, and ordered them into his car. Before they climbed in, he frisked them. Even so, he missed a revolver in the pocket of Joseph Guérin, and when McNeil climbed into his driving seat, Guérin shot him several times in the back of the head. The killer ran off. The other two, a man and a woman, remained and were able to give the police a lead that eventually led to Guérin's arrest. It was then discovered that Sergeant McNeil's killer was also wanted for grand larceny and robbery. He was sentenced to life. McNeil was the second Albany officer to die in 3 days. On the 26th of November, Patrolman Edward Stevens was detailed to collect a woman and to escort her to a mental home, where a court had ordered her to have treatment. As he knocked on her door, she fired through it with both barrels of a shotgun, killing him instantly. The contrast between the two countries is immediately obvious. The British policeman had so little suspicion of the men that he'd stopped that he invited one of them to get into his car while he was sitting down. McNeil did it the right way, frisking Guérin before climbing into the car himself, but he still died. What strikes the reader about so many American crimes involving policemen is their casualness. Obviously, the war between police and criminals is on an altogether deadlier level than in England. Most sociologists would agree that, to some extent, Rousseau, Diderot, Kropotkin and the rest were right. To get the best out of human beings, you need to give them the chance to exercise their freedom. Perhaps the situation needs to be diffused with sympathy and understanding. But it's also obvious that England has fewer police murders because it has fewer guns. It follows that the first step in solving America's problem could be simple: to pass logical and civilized gun laws.